So last time we were left on a bit of a cliffhanger. How will this problem be resolved? Will Boaz and Ruth marry? What about this other kinsman, this nearer family member that he mentioned, who has prior responsibility? It's like the last part of some TV mini-series. All those different threads have to be wrapped up, tidied out. Everything needs to be sorted. At the end of last week's chapter 3, when Ruth came back to her mother-in-law's advice was, sit down, wait until you know how this all sorts out, because he's not going to rest until he's concluded the matter. Ruth was called to rest in a restless Redeemer, one who wouldn't stop, wouldn't give up, one whose resolve was unshakable until he had solved this matter. As Christians, of course, we're called to rest in a restless Redeemer, that we can rest, we can sit, we can know that nothing will stop him until he accomplishes his purposes. Well, we are told that Boaz then went from there straight up to the town gate. He's been kept awake all night, but he doesn't go for a nap before he's up to the town gate. Why the town gate? Why the city gate? Well, that's where business gets transacted. That's where things happen. That's the meeting place. It's the marketplace. It's the town hall, if you like. And behold, oh wow, as if. Look at this. Who should pass by except this near kinsman? We've noted, haven't we, as we've read through this story, how God's providence, his purposes, the little things have been unfolding in the lives of these characters, just as they do in your life and my life. But here comes this man whom Boaz had spoken of. Come here and have a sit down, says Boaz. Your Bible probably translates him as my friend. The Hebrew literally calls him so-and-so. Come here, Mr. So-and-so. Come over here, buddy, and have a sit down. It's interesting. No doubt Boaz knows the man's name. He's a near relative. What do you notice about it? Well, nothing at all. This man is anonymous. This man is going to disappear into history. Hey, buddy, come have a sit down. Well, he comes over. What's this about? And then Boaz gets together 10 elders of the city, who were all just as bemused. 10 elders, 10 witnesses. There will be no arguments later on as to the legitimacy of this. And no one will come back and say, well, what about you? No, this is all going to be above board and duly regularized. And then he sets up this wonderful explanation to the near kinsman. Have you ever come across the phrase bait and switch? And bait and switch. So you're going on holiday. And you go to the travel agent and they show you this brochure. And look at the room. Oh, look at the view out of the window. Look, and there's the palm trees and there's the sea. I'll take that one. But when you turn up at your resort, you discover that your room doesn't look out on the sea. It actually looks out on a car park at the back. But you can't even see the car park because of the cranes where they're building a new hotel. You see the bait and the switch. Well, the same thing kind of goes on here. Here's the bait. Naomi, you remember Naomi, elderly Naomi, the widow who's come back from the country of Moab. Her land has had to be sold. She's landless. The land belonged to the brother Elimelech. And you know how it works in our country. The land title remains in the family. It's a responsibility of the family to buy it back so that she wouldn't be in poverty. Buy it back in the presence of the inhabitants and the elders of my people. And you do this redemption, this buying back. Thinks the man to himself. This land. Of course, at the end of 7 years, the land would revert to Naomi. That was the rule in Israel. Land wasn't bought kind of forever like it is here, but the title would always revert to the family. Land had to stay with the families in this time. And he's thinking to himself, there's a short-term cost. I'm going to have to stump up for this land. But it's really a long-term investment. I mean, sure, Naomi's going to be my responsibility. She's going to come and stay with me. I'm going to have to look after her. But when she dies, she's got no children. Man's going to be mine, thinks the man to himself. It's a very shrewd investment. And you can see it ticking over. He thinks about it for about, well, half a minute. Sure, I'm going to have to move some money around here, but what a great chance. That Philo Elimelech's is fantastic. There's the bait. And then after he said yes, Boaz says, oh yes, and by the way, did I not mention? It's not just Naomi. Look at it in verse 3. Naomi who has come back. Verse 5. On the day you buy it from Naomi, you also buy it from Ruth. Oh, did I not mention Ruth? Ruth the Moabitess. Young Ruth. Ruth still of childbearing age. Ruth who you would be obligated to marry. Ruth who, when she had offspring, notice this, you must marry, you buy it from Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, in order to raise up the name of the dead on his inheritance. In other words, this son, this daughter, this offspring would not count as yours, but would count as the prior family, Mahlon and Elimelech. Ah, bait and switch. You see, that changes everything. Now if he takes the land, now if he marries her, his inheritance gets divided up, and he loses out. Ah, says the man, I can't redeem it for myself. Oops, I suddenly forgot. No, why? In case I've ruined my own inheritance. You have it, I can't have it. Changes everything, doesn't it? You can hardly see the man for dust. And Mr. So-and-so disappears into history. I think we're supposed to see here a balance. Do you remember back in chapter 1, there were two daughters-in-law. There was Ruth and there was Orpah. And when confronted with leaving their own lands, leaving their own family, leaving their people, and leaving their own gods, when they weighed up the cost of that, Orpah said, and went back to Moab and disappeared into obscurity. And Ruth made this costly decision, didn't she? She would commit herself to God's covenant, to God's people, to God himself. I think we had to see a parallel between Ruth Orpah, Boaz, and Mr. So-and-so. Boaz takes on something costly here. Something that the other one wouldn't commit to. But we have seen as we've gone through the book, God's mercy, God's kindness is costly. Surely at Easter, more than any other time, we are reminded of that. God's loving kindness towards us is costly. Because this Friday we will stand on the tump next to a big wooden cross on which we reflect the cost paid by our Redeemer, the one who brought us out of obscurity and poverty and death. How costly that he paid with. Well, there's the bait and switch. This first part of this chapter 4 is really telling us how this crisis is going to be resolved, isn't it? And now this is how it's going to be resolved. Boaz is going to be the redeemer because the other man won't step up. And so now we've got this odd scene. It's almost there in a footnote in verse 7. This was the custom. This is how it used to be. You would, to confirm something legally, you'd take off your sandal and give it to another one. Anyone want it? No, I didn't think so. But that's what they do. They'd hand over the shoe. That's the mark. Why? Seems a bit odd to us. Maybe it dates back to the promise that was given to them that everywhere your foot would step, you would own. Was a promise given to them and coming into the land. Perhaps it's dating back to that. Maybe. Maybe it reflects something that's going on back in Deuteronomy. Do you remember there was an instruction there back in Deuteronomy 25? We saw it last time. If a man dies and his widow is left and she is childless, there's no one to take care of her. Someone else, the near relative, the kinsman, is to marry her, take her into the family, provide for her, fulfill those obligations to her. that covenant responsibility that rests on the family. But if he wouldn't, one of the things that was to be done was if he refused. Well, Deuteronomy in chapter 25 tells us about it. Let's flick back there together to it. Deuteronomy 25. And if he says, verse 8, I don't want to take her, then this is what happens. The brother's wife comes in the presence of the elders. Well, remember, we were gathered in the presence of the elders here, weren't we? Remove his sandal from his foot, spit in his face, and say, this is what should be done to whoever won't build up his brother's house. And this man's family name then becomes the name of who shall be called the house of him who had his sandal removed. It's a shame. You have acted disgracefully. You would not take on your responsibilities. Well, there's this now legally binding framework. You, says Boaz to the elders that he happened to have called together, all 10 of them, you are witnesses, I've bought everything that belonged to Elimelech, and all that was Kilion's and Mahlon's, I've redeemed it, I've bought it back, and notice verse 10, I have Ruth, the wife of Mahlon, I've acquired as my wife. Not particularly romantic language, is it? I have acquired as my wife. But that's the solution, isn't it? That's how we're to get where we were going to get. The threads are being tidied up. It is being drawn together. And then we see a blessing. The people, the elders, this great, there's this wonderful closeness in this community expressed for us here. The way the people gather around. We are the witnesses, but this is not just some vague legal transaction. May the Lord bless you. May the Lord bless your house. May the Lord bless Ruth. It's a good time of great joy in this. Well, there the crisis is being resolved. There's some other things going on in this chapter as well, though. Back in chapter 1, we talked about this last time. Naomi said to Ruth, look, may God give you rest. May God provide for you what you need. May he give you rest and that you would have a home, a husband. That was back in verse 9 of chapter 1. All the way through, we've been asking, how is that promise, that prayer, that blessing going to be resolved? Well, here it is. Here it is. It's being fulfilled because Ruth now has this rest and now has a home. God has provided her with all that Naomi prayed she would have. She's been given a son. Remember, in this culture, what a shame it is to be without children, to be childless. And here her shame has been covered over. And so, chapter 1, verse 9. That prayer of Naomi's is being fulfilled. Boaz took Ruth as his wife, and she conceives. She'd been married to Mahlon probably for the best part of 10 years, and never had children. But notice, the Lord gave. The Lord enabled. It's God's gift on her. And the women gather together, and they bless the Lord. Blessed be the Lord who's not left you. You see, not only is it a promise to, a prayer to Ruth, would you be given this rest, would you be, but there's something else from chapter 1 as well. Naomi says this, she says, I'm bitter. My life is bitter. I went away full. I went away at everything and I've come back empty. Her life has been a train wreck. One disaster after another for 10 years. Now, not only is how is the prayer for Ruth going to be fulfilled, but how is that devastation in Naomi's life going to be reversed? And here is how. The women, notice, say to Naomi, not to Ruth. It's interesting, this. The order in which the characters appear in the book. In chapter 1, we get Naomi, Boaz. And now in chapter 4, we get Boaz does his bit, Ruth disappears. You see that lovely symmetry? As Naomi's desperate plight is being reversed. Bless the Lord. This is how good God has been, say the women. And they respond in this praise and blessing. And they notice, they give thanks to God. Not bless thee, Boaz, who saved the day. No, it's God who is working this out. But there's something very interesting here. Sometimes we have to read things carefully. We have to look at the words. We have to pay attention. Rather than just skipping over or skimming through. Sometimes the things we read surprise us. Verse 14 says, praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. Who is she speaking about? You say, well, that's obvious. It's Boaz, isn't it? Oh, we'll read on. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. Well, it could still be Boaz, but hold on. Your daughter-in-law who loves you and who is better to you than 7 sons. Now, in a patriarchal society, what a shocking statement that is. Your daughter-in-law is better than 7 sons. Ignore the shock value there, but move on. Has given him birth. Did Ruth give Boaz birth? Who is the kinsman redeemer that's being spoken of? It's her son. His name's Obed, which just means servant. Isn't that interesting? Because we'll come back in a moment to that. Naomi's life had been turned upside down. One disaster after another. Some of you know what that's like. Do you remember back in chapter 1 when we were there? There was a word that kept coming up. It's a Hebrew word, well it would be a Hebrew word because it was written in Hebrew, but we translate it into English, but the word was shub, which is translated as restored or return, to turn back. It came up 12 times in the chapter. Now, if somebody repeats a word that often, they're trying to make a point with it. It's not just because they're not very creative in their vocabulary. Okay. This idea of turning back, of being restored, of returning, that word came up again and again and again. And that same word comes up here in verse 15 of chapter 4. He will renew or restore your life. The idea of restoration and return and renewal. And here God is providing for you, Naomi, the restoration, the means of renewal, the return. He is the Redeemer. I hold that thought because we're going to come back to it. I went away full and came back empty, says Naomi. I had nothing. I have nothing. I've lost everything I ever treasured. Life is bitter, she says. Now the women come. As she sits there cradling her grandson. Praise be, Lord. He's not left you. You are not empty, but you are full. God satisfied you with a son, with food, with a family, with community. You have been restored. So that middle section of chapter 4 is this great reversal. Naomi's fortunes get reversed and Naomi's prayer for Ruth gets answered. And then we're just left with this sort of tagged on little bit at the end. Verse 18 to 22. What on earth are we to do with that? It's this family tree. But where does the family tree get us to? Well, it gets us to King David. Jesse, the father of David. Only we call him King David. And there is a sense, quite possibly, what's going on in the book of Ruth. There's a kind of royal apologetic. So David is king, and not everybody is fond of David as king. And so there's something kind of like this going round. You can read it on page 7 of the Express in the letters. It says something like this. You know that King David? Did you know that his great-grandmother was a Moabitess? She's a pagan, she's a foreigner. So how do you respond? Well, this is a kind of royal apologetic. This is explaining how actually this, the king does have a Moabitess in his family line. But she's a good one. And despite the fact that we kind of periodically are war against Moabites, and God says that they're a pagan people who will lead you astray and only cause trouble, you see how it's the same thing in the family line of David. That's what it's in for. But it's this kind of long-term view. It's this, almost this kind of zooming out. Because you will maybe recognize those names not only occur here, but each Christmas we read those opening chapters of the Gospels, don't we? And Matthew 1 begins with a genealogy, an account of the family line of Jesus. And just like people today are sometimes interested in tracing their family trees, I had a message last week from someone in Australia who wanted to know about her great-great-grandfather who was buried in 1902 in St. Prevels, and was he in the churchyard? And, well, people are interested in where they've come from. In Matthew chapter 1, we have an account of where Jesus has come from. And he's come via this family line. He's a descendant of David. He's a descendant of Ruth. There's a hymn we sing, it says, "Hail to the Lord's anointed, great David's greater son." And all these twists and turns that have we gone through in this story, in all the goings on, God's providence provides protection. He is preserving what he is out to achieve. He's got his plans and his purposes. And however odd it seems to us, however confusing it no doubt seemed to these people as they went through it, because this family will come and culminate in Jesus. Today is Palm Sunday, when we have been thinking about his role as king, celebrating his coming as king. Well, God sending a king, sending David, but ultimately sending Jesus. Let me draw three bits of application then before we finish. Firstly, you can't read this book without seeing God's concern for people. His compassion for the widow. His concern for the marginalized. His provision for the poor. The emphasis he places on justice. Those things are embedded in the Old Testament law. And in Ruth and Boaz, we meet people who take that law seriously. Boaz particularly, we see a man who devotes himself to keeping it and following it and applying it. Who does so when it's costly to him, he does so when it's hard. Because he's mirroring, he's reflecting God's concern, God's loving kindness. Now God's costly love, we see, as I've said, finds its ultimate expression at the cross. So we ought to see that. We ought to not miss that, firstly. Secondly, we ought to be aware of this. God has plans. God has purposes. They don't center on you. But they do include you. As we zoom out, as we read that last part, we discover that Naomi isn't the focus in this story. But she is part of the story. She is drawn into God's plan, and this multitude of different threads of different people's lives as they tangle up together are the unfolding of God's plan. And in your own life, God's purposes, his plans, his providence is at work. And you're the strands of our lives overlap, cross, touch each other's lives, other people's lives, and God is at work in them. They're not centered on you, but they include you. We may never see what God is doing with these plans and purposes. We may not ever get to grasp how his providence works out. Naomi had no idea that her great-great-great-grandson would be King David. The great-great-great-great-great-great-great-going-grandson would be Jesus. She had no idea. Of course she didn't. She could never see. You cannot see what God is doing in your life. That doesn't mean he isn't. It means you don't get to see it. The last thing to say, And this is the big theme that comes out of this last chapter, is that God is at work to restore. God is at work to renew, to return. You see, in the book of Ruth, we have the kind of gospel in miniature. We have God providing a redeemer, a restorer, a renewer. Jeremiah describes God as being a bit like a potter. And you come to a pot that's not yet been baked, and the clay's a bit misshapen. It's kind of slumped on one side, not quite symmetrical. The pot has got choices, isn't it? You can throw the thing away. He can sit down, and he can start the wheel again, and he can reshape it. He can renew it, restore it. That is a gracious work of God, to reshape, to reform, to renew, to make good what is broken. God is doing that with his creation. The Bible tells us that all the creation is groaning, waiting to be released. Things aren't as they should be. You know that. Bible tells us that one day God will renew or restore, will reshape. He's doing that with his creation, but he's doing that with. You see, Ruth's descendant, Jesus, going to be Ruth's savior. There is a redeemer promise. There is one who restores, who makes new. It's costly, it's hard, yes. That's what he's going to do. Ironically, a great, 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 great grandson by faith in him becomes her older brother, the one who would bring her to his, the one who would restore you, reshape, reform you, not throw you away, not discard, but wants to, like the pot of us, make good what's broken. When we read this chapter, there is a sense of wholeness. There is a sense of completeness, of making right when we come to the end of this book. This story that's unfolded over 10 years, it began in such a dark, desperate circumstances. And yet we see God at work restoring the brokenness, the disorder, quietly, in unseen ways, and via a faithful Redeemer who would bear the cost. He is bringing peace and wholeness to his... He does everything well. We see it here. We ought to see it when we look to him as our own Redeemer and the one who restores everything.